Welcome to Shelf Talkers, a podcast from Village Well Books and Coffee in downtown Culver City.
Hello, Jared here. Julia and I at Village Well have a wide-ranging, fun, and insightful interview for you all this week on Shelf Talkers. We interviewed the prolific romance and fantasy author Olivie Blake, whose stories and thoughts we barely scratched the surface of. You might know her as a viral TikTok sensation with her self-published fantasy romance success story, The Atlas Six, which later went on with many of her other books, including its sequel, The Atlas Paradox, to get traditionally published over the last few years. Her other books include the romance Alone with You in the Ether, the young adult My Mechanical Romance, and fantasy books One for My Enemy and Masters of Death, and many more. The finale of the Atlas series, The Atlas Complex, came out on January 9th of this year, but you'll notice we recorded this episode actually in December, so there might be some confusion resulting from that. The topics jump around on this one, sometimes without much warning, as the best conversations often do. We dive into ideas like the origin of her pen name, which is Olivie Blake, versus her given name, which she also publishes in some genres under. We also talk about, of course, her new release and what her shelf talker would be for it and its whole series. The publishing world's ways of pitching a book versus as a bookseller, her friendship with the Village Well, how she maintains her creative output as a writer, how much she writes each day, writing what you actually enjoy, subjective omniscience as style with an example in her Atlas series, and books she recommends. We were so blessed to have her on. Let's jump straight into it.
The name Olivie Blake is the pseudonym I used while I was writing fan fiction. Mm. I wanted to write erotica on the internet without my mother finding it. I started writing fan fiction in January of 2016, and I did for, I think, like 5 or 6 years. I felt mentally healthiest while I was doing it, and it felt like, okay, this is like the frequency of life.
Our trademark shelf talking question, shelf talker question, is would you be willing to write a shelf talker, which are one of those little pieces of cardboard that we have lined around our, all around our store, about the Atlas Complex, which is your new release?
Yes.
Yeah, so it just basically pitch your book.
I think that a publishing sales department sells books one way, which is in the most, the broadest possible way.
Right.
And then booksellers sell it in a much more niche way, which is much more valuable. I am far more interested in what a bookseller has to say about a book than in what the publishing sales department has to say.
Because you are an artist who enjoys readers, not a marketer who enjoys advertising
dollars.
Well,
yeah, right. I'm not trying to buy something. Yeah. I'm trying to love something. Mm. And so this is a big job. Like, I'm not
Yeah,
I'm not trained as a bookseller. I've had the pleasure of being in the tour booth the last couple of years at Comic-Con, and I try to hand sell books, like, not telling people who I am, just to, like, pretend I'm a bookseller. Because I want, you know, from a bookseller perspective, what will you love about the book as opposed to, like, why should an enormous demographic purchase it?
Why should a bunch of people barely like it enough to buy it versus why should a few people love it?
The tension between the idea of the Atlas 100%. Six, which is that dark academia, like, six are chosen, but only five can walk away. Like, that's the hook.
Right.
But it's very, you know, even to me at the time when I was writing it, I was like, this is a very derivative hook. This is like something that you've seen before. That's like, oh, you, in order to enter a cult, you have to kill someone.
Yeah. Part of the point of the Shelf Talker is for people in our community who maybe don't know Olivie Blake, but have seen Olivie Blake all around the store.
All around the store.
This is part of my sinister plan. I'm making my way there very circularly.
I can hear it.
Which is part of what you have to love about my books. I, as a reader, I like to be surprised by a book. I am not looking for something that feels like something I've read before. I am looking for interesting voice, interesting form. Mm. I don't need my characters to be good. I don't need the plot to be complex. I just need to be like, yes, tell me this story and I will follow you anywhere. And so I write for the intellectually curious reader, the reader who wants to think about something, the reader who wants to, like, carry the book around in their head for a little while afterwards, like, unravel it and play. I write, like, brain toys.
That's such a fun way to put it.
I'm going to pitch you the Atlas series. The Atlas series is a thought exercise full of brain toys. And at its surface, you know, you can definitely enjoy the Atlas series as, like, a very pulpy, like, are these six characters going to all make out or all kill each other? It's unclear. Like, if you just want, those vibes, if you just want like a little bit of camp in your life and you just want like, oh my God.
A little
God.
Bit of magic.
Yeah, you want some magic. It's a very science-based magic system. Yeah. Like if you are really interested in the kind of like a contemporary world that has been changed by magic, but also not changed, but like magic has not actually solved any problems, then you can read this book and probably have a good time with it. But if you love to be surprised by where it's going, to not be sure who's ending up with whom, to feel a variety of romantic and platonic textures, if the way that you see the world is in a very sexually fluid, ethically fluid, morally gray kind of way, and that's interesting to you, then this is the book you should read.
The ethical questions, I think that's the part that I know that, especially as a nerd myself, like that's what I've enjoyed about reading your works.
Thank you. I love to question ethics.
Well, and I know before we move on too much into the book, we wanted to also hear your story as far as like coming into a friendship with The Village Well.
I'm very happy to talk about this. I feel like a lot of my life, you know, as with everyone, changed a lot around the pandemic. At the time in 2020, I had been living in Santa Monica for like 7 years without noticing. And so I was like, you know what, let's go somewhere that's more pleasant to be, that feels more like a neighborhood in the event that we can eventually venture out. I moved to Culver City, lived not very far from Village Well. I lived near Helms Bakery in a lovely apartment with a very wonderful landlord, actually, very rare.
Yes. Wow, big plug.
Culver
Shout
City.
Out to her landlord.
Shout out to Culver City. Landlords.
I love Culver City. I think downtown Culver City is so cool. And then I was doing a podcast with Drew Broussard, the Tour of Voyage into Genre podcast. Drew's a great interviewer. He is the brother of Valerie Broussard, the singer-songwriter who is native to LA. And her neighborhood bookstore is Village Well.
Wow.
Fun times. I think she had a recent
song. Jen's connected.
With Kygo. Plug for her as well.
Wow. A lot of plugs. A lot of plugs today. There's no competition here. We're just here to plug everybody.
And I really wanted to do, a system of personalization where people could, because people are starting to ask, like, can I mail my book to your house for you to sign? Like, I would prefer that not be the case. So I was looking for a store that we could have, you know, like an easy way for me to come in and personalize it. And, you know, Village Well is such a small neighborhood store that Jen was just like there so I could physically ask the owner, like, can I do this?
Yeah.
And so since then, I think we've established a really good relationship. This is a bookstore that I feel at home.
Well, thank you for explaining that. We're so excited that you are a friend of the store. And I know I've seen you come in to do signings, and people don't know they're out there that we offer through our website. And, and you plug us on your website, I believe, right?
Yes, I do.
I saw the cutest Instagram post from you where you're holding a water bottle. And you're shouting out Village Well. I was like, oh.
So we want to ask, you're so prolific and you write so much. And if you look at our bookshelves, we have you in fantasy. We have you in young adult. We have you in bestseller hardcover, bestseller paperback, things that are just surviving. Cool. And that's not even our decision. That's just the list we get from the publisher saying these are the bestsellers.
Yeah.
And then when you go to your website, you have 3 books coming out next year alone, including The Atlas Complex.
Yes.
And then you have a list of, here are 4 more books coming out over the next decade.
Yeah.
How do you, one, maintain that level of creative output? Mm. And like with that, how do you trust yourself enough to write that much and trust that this is all good and that people are going to love it? Not that you trust that from
trust
a marketer
or
publisher perspective, but I feel like as a creative, that's such a question that I know that I ask.
Yeah. Well, I've now had the wonderful benefit of meeting a lot of other authors and talking about their craft. And so I can tell you that there are a lot of authors who have a very different like mindset than me when it comes to creation. First of all, I should say that I can write that much because I'm very mentally ill. I like to put that out.
What do you mean by that? Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm bipolar. And so like, for me, the creation of art and the act of creativity is something that I use to keep myself well. Mm. It is the thing that I feel most well doing. And I like to talk to people who struggle with depression or anxiety about the ways that creativity is very, you know, medicating almost, that the act of creation is very cathartic. And it's something that I do because I have to. And at the same time, I don't like to linger searching for perfection. So what I was going to say is that there are some authors who I really admire who are extremely talented. Alex E. Harrow, for one. Katie Hayes, who wrote The Cloisters. Mm-hmm. I respect them and their intellect so much. But they do this thing where they rewrite their entire manuscript like 3 times. I'm like, This is not my process. My process is we sit down, we write something. Like I said, I, as a reader, I don't know where we're going. And as a writer, I don't know where we're going, but I also don't need to know where we're going. We'll get there.
And that's part of the helm of healing journey within yourself as you're creating.
That for me is like, we're starting with this clean slate and I'm not intimidated by the blank page. I'm excited by the blank page. Like, I'm going to tell a story to myself. I'm not going to worry about whether it's interesting, whether it can be perfected. I'm going to write it down. Once I understand what the story is, then I'm going to go edit it so that someone else can understand it. But I don't start from scratch is the important detail. So I write something, I write it for me, I write it for someone else to understand, I write it so that it is clean and polished, and then I move on to the next thing. We are not trying to write the perfect book ever. I am not this one project. I am N plus one. You know, I am whatever comes next. I'm everything that comes next. For me, it's a question of like, was I true to what I was trying to tell with the story? Is this story honest in a way that is, you know, important? Like I said, a lot of my books are like thought exercises, something that enters my mind and I'm like, okay, let's work through this, like a therapy session. And then, you know, is it good enough? It's good enough. Now let's try and do something more innovative. Let's do something different. Let's do something that feels bigger in a more, like, in a way that's achievable now because I wrote this thing that wouldn't have been before. But it's always the next thing, which is not always the healthiest, like, mindset, because I'm not good at resting. I'm not good at, like, let's sit in this thing that we've achieved.
It's kind of a gift. It's kind of a treasure, though, because we have so, I mean, I'll say this as an audience member or a reader. It's a treasure because then we get more of you.
If this is what you love, then like sure, have more of it. And if you don't like it, then by all means, leave it for someone else.
I will say as a writer, and both Jared and I are writers and creatives, your work and the way you talk about your work is so validating for me because I find that I'm constantly moving between both reading so many different genres and writing in so many different genres. And then also when I'm getting the advice, start from scratch. Just wanting to start, like this is really great. And you know what's going to make it better is if you just start from scratch.
Start over.
And I'm like, I just have no inclination to start this thing from scratch, even if I'm told.
I think it's a fine but significant line that there are the creatives that tend toward anxiety. And those are the creatives that want to stay in the work and just keep picking at it until it feels perfect to them, which it never will. And then there is the other kind of creative that is the bored creative, like the ADHD. So you have the anxiety creative and you have the ADHD creative. And I'm the latter. For me, I never want to live in one thing too long. I will get bored. I will find that it's not fun. The brain toy has already been like messed with, like the Rubik's Cube. Is solved now. I don't care if it's a perfect Rubik's Cube. I'm moving on.
I love that picture of like a mostly solved Rubik's Cube. And you're just like, that was pretty good.
Nailed it. Like a Rubik's Cube solved by a slightly colorblind person.
Yeah.
Is what I
mean. Yeah, and you're like, this is
it. And you're like, this is fine. Like, it's not going to get better than this.
But it's like, also, I think, a beautiful example of like, nobody needs that Rubik's Cube to be fully solved. Like, the world's not going to stop
with a solved Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, what are the stakes here? Yeah. The stakes are not that high to not solve the Rubik's Cube, so just move on to the next Rubik's Cube.
Someone is always going to be like, that Rubik's Cube is not exactly right, and you can
or
be
somebody's
like,
going to be like, you should have done an 8x8 Rubik's Cube. You should have done more squares.
The execution just isn't there on this
Rubik's.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm moving on to this other thing because, again, I am not the Rubik's Cube.
Wait, so what do you mean by that? You are not the Rubik's Cube.
I am not the Rubik's Cube.
The work is the Rubik's Cube.
I am not any single book. Yeah. I am not the Atlas series. Right. I am not.
So cool.
Which is hard. Like some people will ask me, what's your favorite work? And it's like, well, it's whatever is next. It's whatever is the new thing. It's whatever is the thing I'm thinking about now. Yeah. Like it's never going to be. I am proud of each work individually for different reasons.
And I will say you exude that in a fun way. Like in truly like in a fun way. Like from your social media or your website, like it's clear that you're always like psyched about the next thing.
Yes.
And I think that is really fun to see, and like it makes it more exciting to read your work because we know that you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
Versus the like, you know, I don't know, I'm a big Miyazaki fan, as many people are, but he has got a famous quote where he's like, I like being sad. I make better work when I'm sad. It's like, I love him, but I'm also like, you should probably talk to somebody about that. Yeah. You know, like that doesn't feel healthy.
There is some validity to when I'm sad, I can write something that feels profound.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's better. But I I can see how that's like a temptation. It's like, oh yeah, totally. if I'm suffering for the art, then it has a different feel. It has a different tactility, but that doesn't mean that it's going to speak to people the same way.
I also just really appreciate your way of dismissing the qualification of things. It's like, that doesn't mean it's better. Maybe one person thinks it's better, but that one person does not dictate everybody's idea.
Right. Yeah. Right, well, right, of course, because it's art. If it doesn't move someone to hatred, then was it art? Did you take a big enough risk? Did you swing big enough? Mm.
If someone doesn't hate it, I love that.
We're both writers and we're curious about creative process. We have to ask the question. We've heard that you used to write 10 to 12 hours a day.
Yes.
I'm neurodivergent. I have what's called narcolepsy cataplexy, where I will fall asleep at random, not necessarily random times, but it's hard for me to control my circadian rhythms. I can focus, but I just can't extend that focus. And I'm curious.
You can't rely on it.
I actually
write narcolepsy kind of a lot.
Yeah.
Because I was in an acapella group at college, and the person who was very influential for me, she was the president, and she had narcolepsy as well.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that it was so a little bit funny.
I know. Funny. It is super funny.
Terms of playing, as I do, blending the fantastic and...
It is very fantastic.
Yeah, there's something very fantastic about it, because where are you going in the sleep paralysis? When I was writing, so Gideon has what appears to be narcolepsy.
Exactly.
Because he can't control the line between asleep and awake. And I wanted to blend that with Carl Jung's idea that when we sleep, we are going into the collective... subconscious. So when we sleep, we are all accessing the same plane, which is the dream realm.
I will say, even though I'm bitter almost every day about my narcolepsy, the way that I get over that bitterness, or day by day, basically, I didn't know that Carl Jung idea, but to really sit in the idea that, I'm connected to something. I'm connected to a consciousness that makes my work, that makes my my ideas all the more profound.
Yes.
You're tapping into something. If I can't rely on my wakefulness, I'm going to rely on that.
In Alone With You in the Ether, I wrote in the acknowledgments that you're crazy is your magic. And this to me is so unquestionably your magic. And that's how I would frame it.
Thank you.
Anyway. That's beautiful. There was an actual question in there.
Do you still write 10? What is it like to be mom and writing?
Now that you're also a mother, I know that that's probably a whole different question.
But, it was so important because I couldn't do... So now, people always ask me stuff like, how do you focus or how do you get in the zone? This is not my problem. Everybody's got a different problem, right? I have a hyper-focus problem. I would write for 12 hours and not move from one spot and keep going. And I would write I don't know what my record is, probably 28,000 words in one day. And then I didn't feed myself that day. And I didn't take a shower and I didn't do anything. There's good and bad to everything, but because I had those years, I'm really grateful to my husband for it, because we met when we were pretty young, and so we've sort of taken turns figuring life out, and so it was this moment of I'm always so grateful to him, and I like to say it too, because just for writers in general, you need to have someone who's making money and who's working the 9-to-5 job, and I don't want to act like I didn't have privilege, so he gave me some time to figure this out, and so I would just sit there while he was at work, just write everything I could write, and some of it was free, some of it was for fan fiction, and some of it was self-publishing, and some of it was traditional publishing, and it was just allowed to develop my voice and my style and get my 10,000 hours. And so now that I have a child and absolutely cannot do anything like that again. Before, so my husband is a teacher, thank God, because I used to write my manuscripts over the summer. I would just crash write them. Okay, I have this many weeks to write the entire Atlas Complex, and that's what I did, But now, so my son, I drop him off, I go back home, I sit down, immediately write, and don't stop for 4 hours till I have to go get him. And it's something that I couldn't have done if not for the practice of doing it for those really long. I now understand this is what has to be done. This is what...
And your body understands it.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, it's not... You can't just jump into doing that.
Yeah.
Right. I'm leaning into a strength I already have. I'm choosing to view it as a strength.
It is kind of a bit like athletic training. It's a muscle you've built, and you're a trained athlete in that way.
Yes. And I say this about creativity as well, because people are always like, where do you get ideas from? And unfortunately, the true answer that every creative knows is everything. You get your ideas from everything, everywhere. I was just telling someone that my idea behind the first part of the Atlas Six, it says the moral of the story is this: beware the man. Oh God, I'm forgetting it. something. If you're not right the whatever. It's fine. But the reason that it came to mind was that my old roommate and I were talking about how when you go to Vegas, all these club promoters stop you on the street. As a woman or a female presenting person, club promoters stop you on the street and they invite you to these exclusive parties and you don't have to pay anything. And like, but you do have to wait in line for at least an hour, right? And the reason for that is because you, as the woman waiting in line, are enticing the male customers who actually pay money. Like, they're the actual.
Wow.
So my friend, he said, it was so good too. He said, if you don't know what the product is, then you are the product.
Yeah. And I've heard that about tech too.
No, it's true. It's true about tech. He's actually a systems engineer.
Okay.
And I don't know why we were talking about this as related to Vegas, but I remember that's implanted.
That's a funny example, yeah.
Yeah, it implanted in my head. And I was like, yeah, exactly. Because you, as the woman in your little tight dress, like waiting in line, you are the product. And that's why, wow. You know, you're the advertising. And,
yeah.
And, you know, and so for them to turn that into this like fantasy concept, like this is where ideas come from. Yeah. Nowhere and beautiful. Everywhere. So the point I was trying to make is that creativity is something that you can develop. So like you don't just one day wake up and have these incredible ideas. It doesn't always come to you in a dream. You know, I always say that the first thing you write or the first piece of art you make is always, it's, you know, when you first start drawing, you're tracing. You know, you're looking at something and you're recreating it. And this, it's the same thing with writing. The first idea you have is a pretty simple one because it's probably been done before. Like the first thing that I wrote I wrote a portal fantasy that was extremely Narnia, Harry Potter-esque. But I needed to write that to understand like, okay, this is what character arcs look like. This is what plot beats are. This is what pacing feels like, so that I could then kind of break those rules. Like to understand the rules, you create a thing that looks very similar to a thing that's already been made. Then you expand from there.
And I've heard you say this other interviews, and I just appreciate your explication of that concept. You have to know the rules in order to break them. You hear that all the time, but you've really laid out an understanding of that. Like the way that you talk about creativity, I'm fully able to grasp that idea in a way that I've not in my entire life.
So thank you.
You're a real professor.
Well, I do have to say, so I don't have like a literature background. When I say know the rules, I don't mean like you don't need to study Kafka, but you do need to understand, like people always ask me like, how do you know you're world building correctly? Or how do you know you're doing a right character arc? And the answer is just, what do you like in the books that you read?
Yeah.
What about that speaks to you? And you can break that down into parts. You can understand why certain books speak to you more and which parts of that are like the rule. You reverse engineer what the rule is from understanding what you like about it. So you're never creating something that is universal. You cannot create the universal piece of art. Ooh, that's an interesting concept. Oh, I just love that. Yeah. What if there was a universal piece of art? That would be really interesting.
Okay. How all art points to it in some way, almost like a platonic idea.
Yeah, I feel like that's being built into a world right now, but we won't see it for a few years. I'm going to be like on a podcast some years from now and be like, well, I was doing a podcast for my beloved Village Well.
Another plug. When I read your work, I feel like your style is such a distinctive quality that I tried so hard to figure out how to approach it, but here's my attempt at describing it, and I just want to hear your thoughts on it and like how you arrived at it.
Okay.
So when I read your works, it feels like the narrator is essentially like a person observing it that isn't an omniscient narrator, but is like another human person essentially subjectively experiencing what's going on and then like relating it as best they can. And I wrote a sentence that I feel like is an Ollie Blake-like sentence because in trying to like explain this understanding of kind of your tone of like, okay, he walked up to her with a smile, or at least she thought it was a smile. It could have been a calculated smile hiding yet another grimace he was all too practiced in. Right.
Yeah.
Feels like a thing, right?
That feels like the right rhythm. Yeah.
Right. Something like that. Not to simplify it or make it seem trite, but this feeling of like the narrator doesn't actually know if it's a smile. Like even the narrator is confused in that in that experience.
Yes, the narrator is interpreting.
That to me is something, and I want to know like how much of that style was something that you like arrived at intentionally, or like that the narrator is kind of interpreting through like sort of omniscience, but like omniscience in the sense that they're seeing everything take place, but it's also not omniscient in the sense that you're not always sure if they're interpreting the character correctly to give it to you.
Yeah, so it's, I guess you could say it's omniscient, but not objective.
Yeah, very subjective.
Yeah, that's because I don't trust anyone. I don't believe that there's I don't believe that there is a universal narrator or a reliable narrator. Sure. I think that everybody is telling lies. And when I say that my books have like things for your brain to play with, part of that is which character is telling the truth and are they telling themselves the truth? A lot of the times I find people aren't catching the sort of sub layers of, yeah, sure, a character said this, but did they mean it? Did they mean it? Do they believe in it though? Because those are two different things. Maybe they did mean it and do they mean it? Do they believe it? Is it true? And those can all be different things. And like, if you really dive into what we tell ourselves and the narration we create for themselves, the narratives, I guess, you know, I think that as humans, our way of understanding the world and how we fit into it is to create a narrative. And we are always a character in it, but we're also always a sympathetic character in it.
Yeah, we always representing ourselves as the main character to some degree.
Yeah, and to me, like, this is the most honest way that I can tell a story, which is that this is what this character believes is happening, and that's why they're acting in this way. Whether you as the audience disagree is not necessarily relevant. It might be. In the Atlas series, this is where I do this very directly, which is like the truth is not necessarily on the page, but you as the audience are meant to recognize it. You are meant to see this thing that the character just did is wrong, but they don't believe it and the people around them don't believe it. And what does that mean about the world? Like, what is that like? Sitting with the space between perspectives is where the actual truth is. And that for me is fun. Like, for me, that is a fun reading experience. It's not true for everyone.
It reflects reality more.
I was going to say, And like how, you know, everything is subjective, but insofar as we all think of ourselves as sympathetic characters, we all think of ourselves as reliable narrators.
Right. The Atlas series is very interesting for me because I wrote a corruption arc that many people view sympathetically, that everybody, like that people are interpreting as sort of like a baby girl villain, but she's not. She's a real villain. She's an extremely self-centered person who has allowed her trauma and her pain to rewrite the scale of her empathy. Mm. But because we are able to see that journey from inside her head, it doesn't feel wrong. You can feel it going off the rails. You don't necessarily say that's an evil person. You know, it's like that person. Yeah, so I'm talking about Libby Rhodes in the Atlas series. And Libby is meant to, like, the whole first book is meant to be, this girl could be you. This girl could be your friend. Like, this girl has felt things that you felt. And then over the course of book two, she allows those things to change her in a way that's kind of like, that's the first time I think that you as audience are meant to feel the tension of like, this is going wrong. Like, she's not doing what she's supposed to do. She's acting on what she believes is a universal standard of ethics, but isn't.
Right, right.
And so to see where that goes in the Atlas complex is meant to be conflicting. It's you as the audience. I wrote her this way on purpose. I'm going to take this opportunity to complain. I really resent when people call her a self-insert because people are like, oh, she's a, you know, like obviously the writer loves her so much. Mm-hmm. When like, it should be very clear that I do not.
That you think she's not doing.
Well, yeah. I don't not love her, but she is a metaphor for a type of person who is going to allow, like, who's going to lose their humanity because they allow the world to shrink to their own pain. Mm. And I think that's especially true in politics right now. Like, you know, it's never not true in politics, but like certainly like 2016 onward, we've seen like a type of, you know, voter and a type of idea about the world that is very centered on just one person's pain. And so, yeah, so I wanted to write her that way so that the audience felt the tension of like, I don't want her to do this, but I don't want her, I don't want horrible things to happen to her. So
it is such a, so sensational, the Atlas series, because what you've done is given the audience a space to grapple with like basically ethical thought experiments.
Yeah. So like, if you, this is what I'm saying, is like,
you're giving the audience like a means of basically a route for philosophy for their own like building. Building of ethical.
So like, if you want to, you could read this and really think about it. You could really tear this apart and ask like, what is the ethical decision? Which is like, which parts is each character culpable for? Or you can just read it and be like, who's gonna kiss?
And honestly, that's the best pitch for the book, I think, is that.
I mean, this is another hot, hard question. Okay. But would you be willing to write a shelf talker for one book? And it doesn't have to be your favorite book. It's just one book that you're in your gut immediately just springs up.
Like if you could contribute to our shelf talkers in the store.
Yeah. Like what book does Olive Lee Blake want to everybody to read right now.
Mm. Oh, God.
I know.
Well, you know, whenever this happens, it's like, I've never read a book in my life. I feel this. You must feel this, too, this pressure of, like, you want to pick a book that's, like, by an author of color and a marginalized author and
someone
who's not, like, the hugest, getting the hugest marketing campaign. But also the books that get big marketing campaigns are usually worth it because they're such good books. And then it's just this weird unending thought experiment. Okay. I'm gonna say two books because I read two really, really impactful books this year. And I think they're different enough from each other that we're going to go with it. Okay.
Love it.
So, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden by Joanna Greenberg, which is a fictionalized memoir about a woman she was a girl, 16-year-old who was hospitalized with schizophrenia in the late 60s. I Never Promised You a Rose Garden is for the mentally ill. It's for the people who have struggled with mental illness, but not just the illness part, but with the part of like self-compassion. Mm. That if you want a book that's going to make you feel like you can love yourself and you have a reason and you have the tools, then I Never Promised You a Rose Garden is amazing. From a craft perspective, it is really, really well crafted. It feels like a speculative story because the character has schizophrenia. So every time she enters a schizophrenic episode because she's unable, because there's a trigger or she's unable to like deal with a situation that's happening to her, she enters what's essentially a second world. So it feels like a portal fantasy because she's built in her mind this entire second world where there are different gods and there's a different language and everything means different things, and her trying to like the neurodivergence of trying to wrestle with what are the social cues telling me that I don't understand.
Yeah.
It's like a completely second world in her head.
Wow. That's a cool picture.
Yeah. So it's a really cool book. And it made me, like, I cried, like, 5 times just from, like, catharsis of just, like, you have finally told me something that I can understand. That there's all this stuff about, like, the point is not, like, the idea of being well doesn't mean being cured of sickness. And everything that you think of as the sickness is just a symptom. And it's just this really, really beautiful way. I feel that I can move more easily in the world because I've read this book. And then the second book is An Impossible Thing to Say by Arya Shahi, which is a YA novel written in verse, a period piece set in 2001.
Okay. Wow. That's already 2 decades ago.
Yeah. Well, so that came out this year. It's brilliant. Arya is a friend of mine, and I will be totally honest with you that I was going to lie to him. I was going to be like, oh, yeah, it's a great book.
It's you're prepared
genuinely
to lie.
A great book, again, from craft and form, because the character starts, is a first generation American, is kind of feeling separated from his native language, and he feels separate from his family. He's very shy, he's very introverted, and so initially it's just kind of lines of observation, like unrhymed poetry, and then as he gains this like certainty of understanding, he listens to rap for the first time, he finds his flow, and that is a metaphor for him like understanding himself and the way he fits in generationally. And you know, it's 2001, it's written by a Persian author, so there's the conflict of Islamophobia.
Sure.
And Arya is incredibly talented. It's a beautiful, very quick read. I am really happy that it exists for my son to read someday.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Those were great shelf talkers.
Okay.
We're so thankful, all of you, for you coming through and talking to us and giving us so much great discussion of your books. And thank you for making the time. These shelves talk to us. Isn't that right, Julia?
Absolutely true.
And sometimes we talk back. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Culver and Duquesne. We have a very special little conversation about a book recommendation. Today is our very own first day on the job, Omri Rigby. So Omri has a great recommendation. Omri, what book do you want to recommend to all the listeners and all the Village Well community?
I'll recommend the book Finding Fish. It's a memoir. Actually, some of you all might be familiar with the movie Antoine Fisher, early 2000s, starring Denzel Washington and Derek Luke, also directed by Denzel Washington. So this is actually the memoir that correlates with that movie.
So what about the book that draws you in?
It's an incredible story. I mean, what I love about the book is it's a triumphant tale of Antoine Fisher, who is coming to grips with his life and his journey, going through the foster care system, being institutionalized from birth, quite honestly, being born in prison, going through the foster care system, suffering great trauma and abuse, but learning to find, first of all, healing and recovering from that, giving a compassionate outlook on how he grew up and the many, many trials that he faced that he documents in the book from his really unique point of view and perspective, and also how he learns to find his chosen family amidst all that. What I love about Finding Fish is the mediums that Antoine Fisher uses to build his memoir. I mean, of course, there's prose, but there's also some of his poetry that's in there, which is really gripping. He uses some of the paperwork from some of his case files from his childhood growing up in the foster care system to also interact with and comment on his personal story, which I think is really unique, almost as a witness and a record to the fact that he exists, you know.
I'm curious how you get through a book like this.
With many tears.
You said it's a triumphant tale at the end, so there's something that everybody listening can feel, look forward to. Cool. Thanks so much, Amri, and thanks so much for joining the Village Well Books and Coffee team. Y'all will see Amri behind the register. Say hello.
Say hello when you're in the shop and buy Finding Fish, the memoir.
Looking for links to the books mentioned in this episode of Shelf Talkers? Looking for ways to connect with this week's guest? Maybe you want to reach out to us about thoughts or questions for the podcast. For all of that, check out the show notes beneath the episode. You can also order your books online through villagewell.com. This episode of Shelf Talkers is brought to you by Village Well Books and Coffee. It was produced, edited, and hosted by Julia Elizabeth Evans and Jared Kassebaum. And our theme music is from Noah Vickland. See you in 2 weeks, and keep reading.